Please help me welcome our speaker tonight is from the Friday Night Speakers Group in Lansdale, Charles.
My name is Charles Cappy and I'm a recovered alcoholic. I just want to say it's an honor and a privilege to be able to come up here and speak. I want to thank Rich for asking me. It's funny, Rich bailed me out on Friday night. Our speaker couldn't make it for some odd reason. I reached out to a couple friends and, Rich, accepted and said he would come out and speak for us. And, I love that because, for me, it's really big because when I was out there, like Alcoholics Anonymous showed up for me. And when I reach out for help, like Alcoholics Anonymous shows up. So when Alcoholics Anonymous asks me to show up, I do. And it's an honor and a privilege for that. I have a sobriety date. It's February 24th, 2014. I just want to say, like, my story is my truth based on my experience, right? Like, if there's anything that I say that offends you, like, I'm sorry, I apologize now, but, like, if it's not in the big book, let it go in one ear and out the other. Like, it's just my truth based on my experience. Because I spent it, I have a home group, it's Friday Night Speakers in Lansdale, and that's an hour speaker meeting. It's similar to this format. You grab a cup of coffee, you come, you sit down and, you hear a message, hopefully of hope. Because I know, like, when I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I first came in, I would, go to topic meetings and discussion meetings and, I'd sit there and they'd open up and they'd read a little paragraph or read a couple passages out of the big book or whatever it may have been. And I spend 30 minutes not listening to what they're saying, thinking of the perfect share, looking at the beautiful girl over in the corner and saying, like, I'm going to sound real super sober right now and she's going to love me. I would do that. Like I would sit in AA and like try to think of the perfect thing to say and sound really good from a podium. But when I go home and you follow me home, like I'm living like a scumbag still, sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'll just start like, I can't, today I'll sit here and tell you like my parents were great parents. They were amazing. They did everything they possibly could for me. They gave me a house to live in, put food in my stomach, a roof over my head. But, back then I would tell you, like, they're the worst parents ever. They, they didn't give me anything I wanted. They were never there. They never helped me. But, through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, like, I've been able to see today that they did everything they possibly could for me. And they were always there when I reached out for help and I needed help, but I wasn't willing to take it. There was no traumatic situations that I grew up with. I wasn't abused as a child. Like I said, I grew up in a nice family, nice home. Nothing crazy really happened. I had an older sister. She's a 4.0 student, really smart. So, I wasn't that smart. They always said, like, I never lived up to my potential. Like, I could really be a good person, but I never lived up to the 4.0 who's who of high school students, like, bar. I never lived up to that. So what am I going to do? I'm going to act out as much as I possibly can to get the negative attention pulled away from my sister because I want to be in the spotlight. And that's how I really lived my life. I was like an angry kid. I was kind of crazy. Like second grade, I remember I'm in the schoolyard punching a kid in his face because he looked at me funny. Like, because I just didn't feel comfortable and I couldn't let you like punk me, right? Like you said something smart to me and I'm going to punch you in the face. Like that's how I was in second grade, just uncomfortable and didn't feel like I fit in, right? I have all the symptoms that they talk about at a young age. And, we were a Roman Catholic family. I went to Catholic school, up till second grade and, I had my great grandparents. They were like the rock of the family. We would always go over there for Sunday dinner and we'd always be over there during holidays and things like that. When I was, 7 years old, my great grandmother passed away. So that was like a direct hit to the family. It's the cooking wasn't happening, right? So like, the other women in the family had to step up and start cooking for, holiday meals. And it started to get a little rocky at home. And, my mom was in between jobs and my dad was also in between jobs and they were looking to get a better job, basically, and move out of the city. I grew up in Roxborough, Manayunk area. And, I was 8 years old. I'm living in my great-grandparents' house. I was living with my uncle as well, my mom's brother. And he was like, he was like the cool person that I always looked up to because like he had girls around all the time. He'd always have a bunch of friends. He's drinking on the corner. Like that was something cool to me. So I set out to like be around them all the time. And he would never give me anything. He would never let me drink. And I was like always pissed off that he wouldn't let me. But I knew that, like, once they would allow me, like, that's what I'm going to do because it looks really cool. I didn't drink because, like, I don't know if, you know, like, I didn't feel like I was a part of and stuff like that, but, like, I didn't have this thing that, like, I needed a drink right away. Like, I just thought it was cool, and that was something that they did. When I was 8 years old, I stole a couple dollars from my great grandfather's like wallet or something like that, and they always told me I'm not allowed to have ice cream before dinner. So I ran outside, stole a couple dollars, got some ice cream, ran up to the third floor. Uncle wasn't home. I grabbed a couple of the little bottles of rum that he had in his room, drank it down, ate the ice cream really fast, went to dinner, wake up the next day, and I was in throw up and diarrhea all over the place. So I don't eat cookies and cream ice cream ever. I just will not touch it. And at that point, like, I can't say that when that alcohol crossed, you know, my lips and it went into my bloodstream, like, that I had this crazy experience. I just knew I finally got away with something, and it was something that they did, so I wanted to, you know, get this feeling. A couple months later down the road, we ended up moving from Roxborough, Manayunk area to Plymouth Meeting. And I was really upset at that point. Like, I was really upset that my parents took me from where I finally started to get some friends to a suburb area. We were a middle-class Roman Catholic family. We go to the suburbs. They're a different denomination. They have a lot more money. We didn't have it. So all the kids were, like, rich, basically, and we weren't. I didn't get everything I wanted, and that's where it really started, like, the anger in my soul that I truly didn't feel like I fit in. And I seen all these kids coming from holidays and stuff like that with, like, nice things. They'd come in with an iPod or something like that from Christmas or whatever, and, you know, I see them having it, showing it off, saying, look what I have. And, you know, by Friday, I figured out a way to get in their locker, steal it from them, and I'm showing it in their face on a Friday. Well, then they take me to the principal's office and realize that that iPod that I was showing off has their name engraved on the back, and I'm, you know, trying to show it off. So I started getting a little trouble. So I stopped stealing people's stuff, and I figured out that, like, their parents would go away. They'd go to, like, the beach house, or they'd go on vacation and leave the kids home over the weekend. So I knew what my uncles were doing. They drank. So I was like, you know, we can steal some liquor from your parents' cabinet. We should start drinking. And at that point, like, that's where I felt that I arrived, because all these kids, you know, weren't into doing bad stuff, but I, you know, I was, and I was going to teach them how to do it because I wanted to be cool, and we would drink, and I'd have these, like, you know, crazy experience. Girls were looking at me, you know, I'm like 5'4". I was like 6'2" when I put that liquor in me, you know, and, like, the girls wanted to talk to me. I seemed really cool. And I started to, you know, feel on the inside that I was a part of. I wasn't as angry. I didn't really care about everything from the outside. I just felt okay in my skin at that point. And I chased that feeling for a really long time. And I won't get into a whole bunch of stories, like, cause it doesn't really matter. Basically what happened to me is, like, from that time, I started to drink a lot, basically. Anytime I could, I was, what, 12, 13, 14 years old. I couldn't drink every single day. It was impossible. I couldn't get, you know, to alcohol that much. But when I could, I drank. And, you know, it'd be a weekend where the families would go away or something, and I'm blacked out by Friday night. I'm drinking on Saturday, Sunday, and then, you know, they wake up to go to school on Monday, and I'm passed out in the bush out front in my throw up. And, like, I couldn't understand why they wanted to stop. I was like, I want to do this all the time. And, you know, that went on for a really long time. And I figured out that, you know, there were some older kids in the neighborhood that were had a tax-free business, basically. And I was a perfect candidate because I was a bad kid. And I knew all the rich kids. So I'm like, okay, they get allowances. They want what I have. So I'm just going to start this side business. And that was about 14, 15 years old, and I started doing that. So I was the cool kid at the parties. I had everything that they wanted. And, you know, they started to come around me, and I started to have a lot of friends. And, you know, that really went on. Like, I was drinking every weekend. I wasn't drinking every day yet, but I didn't really have any consequences happen. And, you know, I'll speed it up to high school because that's really how it was. Like, I just drank on weekends and, like, had these cool experiences. Alcohol was starting to, you know, at that point was doing something for me. I started to feel okay and, like, have friends. But I was 17 years old and I'm in high school. And I went to school the one day and, you know, I have this side business going on. And I thought I was Scarface. I thought I was, you know, cool. I thought I was having fun. And, you know, my friends didn't show up to school that day. And, you know, a couple of other people that were around me basically said, like, they got arrested last night. and I think you're next. So I had this ride or die chick that I was dating at the time, right? She was, you know, Bonnie and Clyde style, doing what we were doing. And I was like, yo, we should just take off. Let's leave. Let's drop everything. We don't need school. I make enough money. I could support a family. Let's, like, do this thing. So I had a great idea that day that I'm going to, you know, shack up with her and we're going to take off to New York. And I called my mom, you know, got to tell mom, got to let her know what I'm doing because I'm just some Scarface, like, killing it. And I called my mom and told her, like, you know I'm getting in trouble a lot. I know I'm a burden on the family. So I'm just going to take off. I'm going to change my name, forget you ever had a son. If anybody asks, I'm not around. You never had a son. And she's like, what are you talking about? Like, what? It was like a Tuesday afternoon. She's like, everything was fine yesterday. Like, what's going on? She didn't really know that I was doing this out of her house. I don't know how she didn't. I don't know how she didn't have an idea. But, you know, that's what the cool kids do. You know, you sell drugs out of your parents' house. Like, that's what I thought was cool. And I'll keep it at that. Drugs are a part of my story. But I'll, you know, out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I'll leave it at that. You know, so I take off and I went on the run with this girlfriend. You know, we're in love. We're going to be together forever. And we're going to live like the housewives in New York. You know what I mean? Live in a nice penthouse, you know, live this life. And we went with a friend because he lived in Freeport, New York. And I didn't realize that this kid that we left with was a part of the whole operation that got my friends arrested. So he was like real cool. He's like, yeah, you can stay at my house, like no problem. He's a little older, and I didn't really think anything of it because he was always around. He'd buy us booze, so I'm like, cool, we got to connect. And so I'm staying at his house, and, you know, I was up there for about 2 months until I found out, you know, he's banging out my girlfriend, and I had an idea that he was kind of a part of this whole deal that's going on. I got really paranoid, so what do? I quit the business, and I go home to mom. And I show up at home, and she's like, you know, you can't be here. The cops were just here. They've been looking for you the past 2 months. Like, you need to go turn yourself in. You can't live here. And so she takes me to the police station, basically. I was like, all right, mom, like, you know, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm changing my life around. Well, when I went to the police station, basically what happened was they didn't need me. They got everybody above me, and I basically turned myself in for nothing. They were like, kid, you really don't need to be here. But since you're here, we're going to book you anyway. And I was pissed. I was really upset. So what happened, like, you know, I got a slap on the wrist, basically. I got 6 months probation. They were like, don't do it again. I got adjudicated as a juvenile. It's funny because, like, I made it up to be some big thing. Like, I was a petty crook. Like, I wasn't no big-time thing that I thought I was. But they basically caught me on camera and microphone with this same kid that I was with that was, you know, sleeping with my girlfriend. On microphone and camera, and you know, they look bad upon those things. I probably shouldn't be doing that stuff. But they did it. It was 2 days before my 18th birthday. So the way it worked out was I was technically a juvenile at the time of the crime, and, you know, basically got washed as a juvenile crime. Thank God. And at that point, like, my parents were like, you got something going on. Like, you need to get your life together. So I'm like, all right, I see my older uncles and stuff like that. They've been to the military, so what am I going to do? I'm going to go in the military, get my life together. So I go to the recruiter's office. I couldn't pass the drug test. I was trying to study. It just really wasn't working out too well. That's one of the requirements that you have to go through. And, you know, a couple weeks pass by. I'm going to this, like, PT training. I'm trying to get involved. I'm trying to do this thing. And I finally pass this test because I drank a ton of water. I drank, like, a gallon of water the day before, and I finally go in. They were like, all right, cool. Tomorrow we're going to take you to MEPS to sign up. So I call my boys. I'm like, yo, I'm going away. I'm going to the military. Let's have a last night hoorah. And, you know, so I'm like, I go to this party. Basically, we have this big party. We're drinking, having fun, saying goodbye to everybody. And then in the back of my head, I remember there's this kid that owes me $20. And I'm like, I need my $20. I'm never going to come back. I need to get that $20. So I tell my friends to call him, tell him to come give me the $20. He's like, you're going to have to take it from me. I'm like, no problem. Show up. And I'm half in the bag. Like, at this time, there's like probably an hour and a half until he showed up. And I was way too drunk to fight. It wasn't happening. But he showed up, and I wasn't going to let him punk me. So we walked down to the park, and, you know, he kicked my ass, basically, really bad. It was not good. He kicked me in my face. My tongue was hanging off. It was a whole mess. And basically, I walk up the hill. Like, I leave this park after he beat me up, and I told everybody that he didn't, but he really did. He handed it to me. I walk up this hill and I'm walking. My friends are like, you had them. It's all good. You'll be fine. You're going to the military tomorrow. You can get them when you get back. And I'm walking up the street and I look in a car mirror to see my face. And it's like black and blue. My tongue's hanging off. I'm bleeding. I got pretty upset. You know, girls aren't going to like me looking like this. So I punched the mirror off. And I go up the street and hit like six or seven different car mirrors off. Well, that sixth or seventh one, there was a guy in the car. He opens the door, didn't want me kicking off his mirror, so he punched me in the face and held me on the ground until the police showed up. And I don't know, they frown upon it. You're not supposed to do that. His wife was in the car. It was like a really bad situation. So he's like holding me on the ground, and I don't even know why I sat there. I have no idea. But the cops showed up. I seen the lights. I run. I was like, I'm not staying here. Cops run after me. Not really. They were actually walking. But I run down the hill of this yard, and I go to jump over this fence, and I fold over the fence. And they're like, you done running now? I'm like, yeah, I guess. So they grip me up, slam me on the car, put me in the car, and take me in for, like, disorderly conduct and, you know, a bunch of stupid stuff. And this is where, like, consequences of my actions started happening as a result of drinking. And I go to this precinct, whatever, they book me, and I had to, you know, basically breathe a 00 because I was underage prior to getting out. And my parents had to pick me up. My dad came, picked me up, looked at my face, was like, what happened? I was like, nothing. I ran into a car. Didn't really tell him about it. You know, he takes me home, and I remember that I got to go to the recruiter's office. So I'm real late. I go to this recruiter's office, face all busted up, and he's like, what happened to you? You were supposed to be here at 10 a.m. It's, you know, 3 in the afternoon. I was like, it's all right. You can still send me down. Like, my bad. I was a little late. I overslept. He's like, what's wrong with your face? You had a black eye, and my tongue's hanging off. And I was like, nah, you know, I fell, this, that, and the other. He's like, really? Because I got the report. You got arrested last night. I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot. I left that out. Yes, I did get arrested. So he basically told me to go kick rocks, and I'm never allowed in the military. So that plan was up. I ended up, you know, that's where, like, the consequences of the drinking started to come up. But, like, I really didn't think it was a problem. I was just like, I can't fight when I drink. I can't, you know, do these things. So I started to try to change it up. I'm going to drink at home, or I'm only going to drink on a weekend. I'm not really going to do these things anymore. So I had another bright idea. I'm going to get my life together. I'm going to go in the union. I'm going to get a job in the union. That's what people do. I wasn't going to college. So I go to try to get a job at the shipyard down in South Philadelphia. And I go in the union. Basically, they accepted me. And I didn't understand that, like, you have to show up at work every single day. You have to stay for the entire day. During the probationary period, you can't miss any time at all. Within that probationary period, I totaled my car 3 times due to drinking. No DUIs. I have no idea how. I believe God was in that situation. You know, I had a couple family deaths that kind of, they alleviated, you know, the latenesses or the missed days. And they, like, kept extending my probationary period. It's supposed to be 90 days. It ended up being like 6 or 7 months. And at the end of that 6 or 7 months, I was probably like a month away from getting off this probationary period. And I couldn't make it into work that next day. And when I came in, I ended up coming in late because they called me. They were like, this is your last straw. You got to get in here. And I was trashed. I couldn't make it. And I walk in and, you know, you probably shouldn't be drinking and welding at the same time. It doesn't really work out too well. So they pulled me in the HR department. And we're like, yo, what's going on with you? Like, you look a mess. And I was like, nothing. I didn't get too much sleep. You know, I don't feel well. They're like, okay, cool. Like, I understand that. You know, we feel bad for you. Breathing this breathalyzer. And I was like, well, I smoke. I can't really breathe too heavy. Like, I can't do this thing right now. They're like, okay, well, then pee in this cup. And I couldn't. Basically, like, I used to say that, like, I quit. I really didn't quit. Like, I got fired, basically, because I refused to take the test. So we parted ways. And there's another, once again, like, now losing a job due to, you know, drinking and, you know, crashed in the cars. And these consequences started getting more frequent. And, you know, three days later, basically speeded up. Like, my family really tried to have an intervention on me and told me, like, it's either hit the streets or, like, go to treatment. You know, you got to do something. Because I didn't know in this period of time, like, they were talking to some people. And I ended up in Malvern Treatment Center. And that was my first treatment center. I was, like, 19. And I go in this treatment center and basically, like, you know, the book talks about it where you get the self-knowledge. I go to this doctor, you know, I go to the treatment center. I get some self-knowledge. I understand what's going on with me. They sit me down in the chair, ask me why I drink. Like, I have no idea. You know, because I don't have any traumatic situations. I'm hearing this stuff in group. I'm like, It's not me. I just like drinking. I like the effect produced, it talks about. So they tell me, like, you know, they give me a whole bunch of stuff. They put me on psych meds. They tell me I got to go to outpatient. I got to go to a recovery house. I got to go to a bunch of AA meetings. All great stuff. I don't think that at any point when they were telling me that stuff that they were trying to harm me. They were just pointing me in the right direction. So I go to this. I go 30 days. Everything was fine. I go to this recovery house. 30-some dudes in this house. I start going to AA meetings. And, you know, I don't blame it on anybody that, like, I didn't hear the message and I didn't hear what was in this book. I basically walk into these meetings that I was going to, and there was a guy in the back corner with a big book preaching, screaming at everybody, telling them, this isn't in the book, you know, and they told me to stay away from that guy. And I did. That's what I did. You know, they told me not to go near him. I'm listening to the majority. I like people pleasing, so I stayed away from him. And, you know, I was just talking about this earlier. Like, I was 60 days sober out, you know, at this recovery house, and my parents wanted to celebrate my 60 days of sobriety. And I go to, like, the Spirit of Philadelphia. It's probably a bad place for somebody that's, like, not working a solution and, like, not doing anything. But it's, like, drinks going around, you know, and with my family. They're trying to have a good time. They were trying to celebrate something for me. And I'm, like, on this ship, like, trying to call this sponsor that I had. And I'm, like, yo, I'm on this ship. Like, I'm jumping off. Like, this is it. I'm either going to punch everybody in the face, freak out. They're trying to offer me drinks, this, that, and the other. I was like, I'm 19. Nobody ever offers me drinks. I was like, I can't do this. And he's like, it'll be okay. Just think it through. You called your sponsor. Everything's going to be okay. I'm like, I'm going to kill somebody. Like, I want to either jump off this thing. I'm going to kill somebody. Like, it's not working. And I don't blame anything on him either. He was doing the best that he possibly could with the facts that he was armed with. Basically, I'll speed it up. Like, I go back to this recovery house. I stay there a couple more months. I go back home because mommy and daddy think I'm doing good. I go back home. I go to AA meetings like they tell me, and I wasn't feeling better. So at that point in time, like, I knew what was going to give me relief, and I went to go get it. And I did that back and forth for a couple, you know, probably two more years. I was in and out of treatment center. I was in and out of detox. I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I'm sure during that period of time, somebody was trying to give me the solution. But they told me to stay away from them, and I wasn't going near them because that's what they told me to do. And that just was my experience. Like, I don't stand up here and say what's, you know, an ego trip that nobody tried to help me. But at the point, they weren't armed with the facts. So I'll speed up to February 10th, 2014. February 10th, what that looked like was my parents kicked me out because I was drinking and doing other things. And, you know, they basically told me you can't live here. So I wanted to go detox in a shed down the street. That was my new staying place. It was a shed that was like two houses down from my mom. It's a pretty nice shed. It was like 4x4, probably like this space. I got one of those cushion, like outdoor cushions, put in the corner. Had a little space heater, one of those electrical cords like from my parents' pool. And it was like long enough to hit this shed. It was really cold outside, and, you know, I had my drinks. I was working. I don't know how I had a job, but I was like working at this time, and, you know, started a side business again because I was like off the grid, I thought. I don't know. So basically, like, that was my life. Like, I was like living in sheds. I was in bandos. I lived the whole horror story and stuff, but I wanted to get back home. Like, I was sick of living this way. I couldn't drink. I couldn't get sober. Like, I was just back and forth in between both. And I wanted to get sober, but I didn't know how, and I couldn't. My insurance was pretty much run out at that point. Because they don't like when they, like, try to give you help, and then you go into that treatment center and try to throw a chair at somebody. So they, like, report to your insurance company to, like, never let this kid back. Because that was crazy. And so I'm living in this shed, basically, and I'm going to work and then coming back, going to work, coming back. And, like, I'm trying to, like, detox myself and get sober, like, just to be able to live back in mom's house. And February 10th, I leave for the day with one of my friends, and I left some things in the shed because I knew I was coming back there that night. And apparently there was the lady who actually lives there was standing outside and seen me. I run, get in this car. I didn't think she'd seen me, but she actually did. It was like 18 inches of snow on the ground, and there's like tracks, you know, obviously from the shed to the street. So I get in this car, and I leave, and I come back later that night. And there's a padlock on the shed. And I'm like, I didn't lock it. I didn't think there was a padlock on here before. So I'm trying to, like, if you've seen the picture, like, I, like, grabbed an ice ball and tried to, like, break this padlock off out front of her house. I'm, like, screaming, trying to kick this door down. and it wasn't working. And the lady came out, basically. So the lady comes out and sees me. I'm out there screaming at her shed, like, because I had stuff in there, like my backpack full of clothes. It's probably not even my backpack. You know, and my stuff in there. And I was freaking out. I don't know why. I ran, basically. She comes out, I run. And I stayed out for a couple more days. And, you know, I realized my sister's birthday is February 14th. It's Valentine's Day. So I had some kindness in my heart. I got paid. So I take some money and I put it in a card and I go to my sister because she was always there for me. I don't know. She's got this God thing going on and I didn't know it until now. And I go and give her this birthday card and wanted to say happy birthday. And she's like, well, you know, another thing, the police are looking for you. They found your backpack and they want you to come talk to them. So I'm like, well, it's not even my backpack. I'll tell them they, you know, somebody stole it and it's not mine. She's like, well, can you just like, I'm sick of having, that's what I want for my birthday. Can you just handle this stuff? So they stop knocking on the door. So, you know, I give her this birthday card and I tell her to turn me in. I wouldn't say like at that point I wanted to get sober because obviously my sobriety date's 10 days later. I go in and I, you know, I turn myself in. I basically tell them like, I don't know why I even admitted to it because my lawyer told me later that you probably didn't have to, would have got away with it. But like at that point I was just like trying to get this stuff over with. Like I just wanted to, you know, try to fix this stuff. And I turn myself in, they put me in the cell and I'm sitting in there and I'm like, this sucks. Like, I'm not trying to continue to do this stuff. I'm in and out of cells, in and out of detox. Like, what am I going to continue to do this for? I just don't want to live this way anymore. And, you know, I was wearing sweatpants and compression shorts. So like they give you one pair of clothing in there. So I had to like take the sweatpants off because the compression shorts were long enough. And I was wearing like just a hoodie and a beater underneath. So they took the hoodie. And I'm laying in there with like compression shorts on and a beater, and that sucked. It was cold. And so I hit my knees because I'm like, all right, like they tell me to pray and like ask for help. So I hit my knees and I ask God for a blanket. Right? I'm like, it's cold. I want a blanket. If you can do that, like maybe we'll talk about some more stuff. And sure enough, like I swear to you, like probably 20 minutes later, this lady comes in with a fire blanket. And was like, you know, it's probably cold in here. Like, here's a fire blanket. And I was like, all right, you're good, God. Like, how about get me out of here? Like, how about that? And she comes in like 5 minutes later and was like, oh, you're probably not seeing a judge tonight. It's Valentine's Day. You know, people have husbands and, you know, like wives, you know, they don't see anybody on Valentine's Day. I was like, oh, you suck. I want nothing to do with you. And, you know, sure enough, a half hour later, you know, I'll speed it really up. Like, I ended up seeing a judge that same night. They let me out on unsecured bail, and I got out that night. Pocket full of money. They let me out of jail. They messed up. I try to go home. Nobody's home because, you know, again, it's Valentine's Day. You know, people generally do stuff for Valentine's Day. If they're a couple, they're married. So my parents went up to the Poconos. My sister's birthday, she went out. So I didn't know how to break in the house. I'm going to get inside and sleep because there's a padlock on my shed. So basically like I break in the house, I stay in the house. I had some money, so I got what I needed and I was all right for a couple days. A couple days pass, you know, it's a really bad snowstorm. They got stuck up the Poconos. And my sister was somewhere and, they came home a couple days later and, I get scared. Like, I'm really fearful. Like, even though I try to come back and, like, I've stolen from family, I've, you know, said what I needed to my family. Like, when they came home, like, I felt this utter, like, fear. I couldn't be there. I couldn't face them like I was because they told me next time I see you, I want you sober. So I left and I went in their shed, right down the hill next to the pool. I broke the lock off and, you know, I had a rock that time. And I break in the shed and I stay in the shed. And basically, I had what I needed to finish the job. I basically, you know, at that point, like, I asked God to, like, take me out of here. Like, I don't want to live this way anymore, so just kill me, basically. And I had enough to do what I needed to do. And, you know, I do all the stuff, and, you know, I know it now. Like, I came to the next morning. The shed doors were open, and it was my dad. But at the point, in that moment, I thought God took me. I was, like, bright shining light. I turn around. I don't know what's going on. I'm like, you finally did it. And no, it was my father. And he breaks down. He broke down, hit his knees, and starts crying. And was like, I cannot continue to. I was like 120 pounds, like 185 now. So, you know, you could tell. I was a mess. I was completely strung out. And he breaks down and was like, you got to go. You can't be here no more. You know, I try to help you, and you just throw it right back in my face. And I wouldn't say, like, at that point that I wanted to get sober. It was February 23rd. Like, not that I wanted to get sober. I still had some stuff left over. Like, I knew that that's only going to last so much, and I don't get paid until next week, and I'm probably going to lose my job anyway because I missed a couple days. And I basically go in the house, and he's like, you know, take a shower and call somebody, try to figure something out. And I go inside, and I go to take a shower, and I get out, and I felt really bad prior to going in that shower, but, you know, 15 minutes later, I get out of the shower, and, like, I don't want to get sober no more. Like, I was like, all right, I feel a little bit better. I'm not hurting, so I'm going to bounce. Like, I'm good. I'm out of here. And he hands me this card with Montgomery County Crisis Center on it. He's like, you don't got insurance anymore, so here's somebody that you can call, because I know you don't know nobody that's going to help you. So maybe try giving these people a call. He gets in the shower. So I, like, before he gets in the shower, I call them, basically tell him to come pick me up and take me to treatment, because that's what he wanted me to say, or I would have had to leave at that moment. He gets in the shower. I'm trying to figure out how I can get to his wallet, you know, how I can get more stuff. And he took the wallet in with him, so I couldn't get in there. So I'm like bugging. I'm like, these people are on their way. I'm not trying to get sober. I'm not trying to do this thing. Like, I messed up. And they show up, poor ladies. I was like kicking and screaming. It was like dropping a kid off at daycare, but they were taking me away. I was like screaming, not trying to go. They were like, you got to come now. Like, or we're going to 302 you because you're acting crazy. So I was like, I'm not going to the psych hospital. I'll go to treatment. That's fine. And I'm in the back of their, you know, I'm back of their van doing what I have to do, finishing up what I have, trying to like sneak it in, but it wasn't working. She turned around, seen what I was doing, pulled over, took it from me, and I was bugging. They dropped me off this treatment center that I've been to multiple times. Nothing was different, right? I go in there. That time I wasn't like the rehab like president. I wasn't like hitting on the girls. Like, I was dying in bed for like probably 12 days. And, you know, I go through the treatment center. I know I got court at the end. I know after the 30 days, I got to go to court and I got to answer to the judge again. And I go to this, I go through the treatment center. Basically, I go to court and they basically, you know, I waive my completion letter. Like, here's another one for the stack. Like, I'm going to get sober this time. I'm going to do it, lying through my teeth. And he's like, that's cool, but we're going to send you to jail because you obviously don't know how to live out here. And one of those ladies was sitting in the back in the courtroom, I didn't know, from Montgomery County Crisis Center, and said, no, we got him a bed in Florida. We're going to send him down to Florida if you would allow that, to just postpone this, you know, the trial until then. And that was God, man, sitting in the back of that courtroom. And, you know, they sent me down to Florida. And I've been to this place that I was in Florida at before. And I go in and they basically sat me down. It sucked. I was pissed. He's like, look, dude, I sit down with the one counselor, like the intake guy's like, look, you're a charity case. Like, I'm going to tell it to you straight. Like, they don't play no games down there. He's like, you're a charity case. You don't have insurance. Give us any type of deal. Like, you're not going to do this stuff. Like, you can bounce and we'll call the U.S. Marshals. They'll pick you up. Like, we're not dealing with this thing. You're going to either sit in here and do what you got to do and make use of this scholarship, or you can bounce right now. Pack your stuff. And I didn't have the backpack no more, and I wasn't carrying no clothes. So, you know, basically I just did something different. And they take you out to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings down there. Like, they don't bring it into the treatment center. They send you out. They get you in a druggy buggy and they take you out. So basically I go to this meeting and I hear this dude that I seen before that was one of those big book thumpers. And he starts talking about some things and telling me, you know, basically telling my story. But there was something different that he said, like, at the end of his talk was, you know, a lot of people tell you to get a sponsor that you can relate to and that, you know, they got what you want and this, that, and the other. And I was always looking at what shoes you got. Is your girlfriend pretty? What kind of car are you driving? What's your house look like? This, that, and the other. And he said, you know, that's what people look for. But do you look for a sponsor that's had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps? Is that what you're looking for, or are you just looking for somebody that looks cool? And I was like, well, I've always looked for people that were cool and I haven't stayed sober, so maybe this thing will work. And I messed up like real bad asking him to sponsor me. Today it's a blessing, but at that point, like, I go to ask him, I'm like, will you be my sponsor? He's like, do you have a big book? I'm like, no, I don't need one. I'm good. I don't need to read a book. What's that going to do for me? And he's like, oh, really? Cool. Well, here's a big book and we're going to go out in the parking lot and talk. And I'm like, I'm good, dude. Like, I got to go back to treatment. He's like, I already know all the counselors. Like, you're going to come and sit with me. And he talked to my counselor, and we basically go out inside, and you know, we start talking about the stuff in this book. And every time those counselors would sit me down and ask me why I drank, and you know, this, that, and the other, what's the underlying things, and this, that, and the other, he read the doctor's opinion with me, and talked about, you know, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I resonate with that, you know, and realizing that I have an allergy to alcohol, and that there's this phenomenon of craving that develops instantly when the drink comes into my body. So when I take a drink, that phenomenon of craving develops, and it takes me places that I have no idea where it's going to take me. And that happens instantly. I just don't realize until 3 months later when I'm in a treatment center or a jail cell. The phenomenon of craving happens instantly. And when I go to that treatment center or that jail cell, that when I get out of there, my mind tells me it's a great idea to do something crazy or to drink. And at that point, the phenomenon of craving develops, and I run on this hamster wheel, right? And that's what happens to me. And I start to resonate with that. And I'm like, yeah, that's it. And then he starts talking about God. And I was like, whoa, I don't know about all that. Because I knew who God was, right? Like, I grew up Roman Catholic. He hates me. You know, I don't want nothing to do with that dude. Because if that's how I got to get sober, like, I'm screwed. Like, I might as well leave now. And he's like, do you believe that I believe? Are you willing to believe that this might work for you? Like, let's talk about that, but like, do you believe that this stuff will work for you or not? And I was like, well, I think it works for you. He's like, all right, cool, let's keep it moving. And he talks about that we got to say this third step prayer. We got to make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to this God. And I'm like, I don't even know who this dude is. So he's like, let's go out in the parking lot. And we walk down this alleyway outside the clubhouse, and we start walking down. And you know, he's like, all right, get on your knees. I was like, whoa, dude, like, you talk about God, now I got to get on my knees? I ain't doing that. I was about to punch him in his face. I was like, well, I'm not getting no on my knees with some dude in the parking lot. Like, that's not happening. But he's like, no, stupid, like, we're doing the third step prayer. And I never heard that. Like, I didn't know what this stuff was about because they told me, like, do a step a year. You don't even need to do the steps. Like, you can just sit in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't drink, go to meetings. It works. Ain't worked for me. So he's like, let's start, you know, let's get on our knees. Held my hand. It was real awkward. And we say this prayer. We get up, and he tells me, you're well on your way, and, you know, we're launching out on this course of vigorous action. And I was like, what is he talking about? Like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he hands me a paper. Like, he already had a setup, like, for the fourth step. And he's like, here's your fourth step. Start writing. He's like, I know that you have a bunch of time. We're in a treatment center. You don't got nothing else better to do, so write. I was like, whoa, they told me you're like big, bad, four step. You're not supposed to write this stuff for a year. You're supposed to do this, that, and the other. And he's like, you want to stay sober or not? What do you want to do here? It's like, I want to get sober. Like, I was kind of scared of him. So he hands me this four step and tells me to write. He's like, I know your schedule. You wake up at 8. You go to group. You have 25 cigarette breaks in between. You eat lunch. You go back and you chill out at the house for a couple hours. So instead of watching TV, instead of smoking a ton of cigarettes, how about you sit down and start writing your four step? And he's like, and I'll call you tomorrow and see how you're doing. And like, I didn't want to let him down. Like, I was like not trying to hear it because he always had something to say. So I write this four step, like in a couple days. I called him the next day. He's like, did you start writing? And I didn't. And I said I did. And he's like, oh, okay. Like, ask me something like about the part. He asked me like, what are this, like for the effects of my, like, what are the, you know, what are you supposed to write about? And I had no idea. He was like, all right, you're lying. So how about you actually like sit down and write it? And I'll call you tomorrow. And so I basically write this four step, and he comes to the treatment center like 2 days later to sit down and do my fifth step with me. And he listens to me and, you know, starts to weed out all the BS that I was telling him and starts to see my part in these things and talk about my fears, my sexual misconduct and all this, that, and the other. And it wasn't as bad as I thought. I thought it was some crazy thing. And at that point, like, I've never told everybody everything, right? Like, I would always tell you what you needed to hear to get what I wanted. And you never, like, nobody ever knew who I really was because I didn't even know who I really was. And if you knew what I thought of myself, then you wouldn't want to be around me. And I told him everything, and we hit our knees, and, you know, he's like, thank God for, you know, allowing you to know him better. And he's like, go home. Not go home, really, like, go to your room in the treatment center and sit down and don't do anything for an hour, you know, and sit down and talk to God and look through these first five proposals and see if you left anything out. And we'll talk tomorrow. And, you know, sure enough, he was there in the morning already, the next morning. and took me out. And we talked about 6 and 7. We started talking about the amends process. And he's like, obviously, you're in a treatment center. You can't do all your amends right now, but you can call some people on there and talk to them. I was in Florida. I couldn't make certain amends. You know, I saved my parents until I was sober a little bit just because my life hasn't changed too much. They'd see me a couple months ago, like, in a shed, right? Like, trashed out of my mind. So I needed a little bit of time. And, you know, we go through the steps, basically. I get out of treatment center. I go to a recovery house. And, you know, I start making some amends and things like that. And we go through 10, 11, and 12. And he starts talking about the 11th step and, you know, to deepen your experience with God. And that, you know, it talks about in here, like, see where religious people are right and make use of what they have to offer. And I was, like, a little lenient on that stuff. I was like, yeah, I'm good. Like, I don't really need that stuff. And he's like, all right, go start sponsoring guys. Like, start giving this stuff away. And for a long time, like, while I was down there, you know, I was sponsoring a lot of guys. Like, that's what they did down there. It's like a mill. You know, if somebody comes into treatment, you go to that treatment center, you take them through 1, 2, 3, hand them a 4-step, and, like, you run the mill. It's like a mill down there. And it's really good because it's good for people to scrape them up off the street, get them well, quick. But there's a little more to it that I ended up experiencing. And I ended up leaving because I had to answer the charges. I had to come up here, go back to court, and answer the charges. And I was in a real weird spot because down there in Florida, and like I found it up here, but down there in Florida, it was like solution-based. Every meeting you go to is solution-based. Like that's how it is. Up here, it was a little different for me and my experience. But I ended up plugging in with the right people. And thank God, when I came back up here, I was a little squirrely. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. All my friends are gone. Like, we're not running the mill like we are down there. Like, it was real cool. But when I came up here, like, I didn't know nobody in recovery because I only lived the way I lived up here. And I went to this meeting down in Fraser, and there was this dude that raises his hand and, you know, the announcements at the beginning, and he talks about PENCIPA, the Pennsylvania Conference of Young People in AA. And I went to FICIPA, which was Florida's Conference of Young People in AA down in Florida. I'm like, they got that everywhere? Like, I was like some crazy 1,400 people down in Florida, like at the PGA resort, balling. Like, they told me I couldn't have fun in sobriety. Like, that's a lie. It was crazy. It was awesome. It was really good. And, you know, I go to that conference down there and I come up here. I'm like, what am I going to do? Like, this is no fun. People drink, don't drink and go to meetings, smoke cigarettes, drink coffee, go to IHOP. Like, what else do you do? I didn't know, like I had no idea. And I come up here and I go to that meeting and he talks about PENCIPA and he's like, we're having a meeting this day, you know, next week, and we're going to vote on positions. And, you know, I share my experience with, you know, how I was at FICIPA. Like I wasn't in a position down there, but I was telling them about it and they were like, oh, so you know what a good, you know, a conference looks like. Awesome. You can be the outreach people, you know, and help with the special events. And, I got thrown into service. And at that point, like, it was like two-stepping, basically. I was sponsoring guys in service in AA, speaking a whole lot, traveling all over the place, doing a whole bunch of great stuff. And it was awesome. I can't say that, like, that was a bad thing at all. I was really heavily involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, but, like, my life didn't look too great on the outside. I did make amends to my family, but it didn't, you know, like, I didn't repair those relationships. And I was, you know, going all over the place, you know, like we were just talking about it before the meeting. Like I had that experience too, like out to dinner with my family for like, you know, a birthday or something. And I'm answering phones from sponsees like outside, like not even at the table, or like a family party happens or something, you know, great happens. I'm not there because I'm speaking or I'm doing something different. And, oh, I can't, you know, I can't make commitments to the family, but I can to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what happened for a really long time, you know, probably 6 months training. And I hit a spiritual bottom, basically. You know, I sounded really good up here. You know, I sounded really cool and like, you know, I look nice, this, that, and the other. But like when you follow me home, it didn't look like that. Screaming at my family, arguing all the time. They were upset that I'm always at AA. I'm not doing anything for the family and this, that, and the other. And, I hit a bottom in sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God, like I didn't know anything was wrong. I didn't know I was delusional. But I sat down with a guy who's my sponsor today and he told me like, my man, like your life looks nothing like rigorous honesty. Like you're straight up delusional. Like you sound really good and you can quote the big book and this, that, and the other. But like, what are you doing? Like, what does your life look like? Like you're committing to work in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, how about the family? How about like the 11th step that you swear you're never going to do? Like, what are you doing? And That hit me to the core. It really did, because he was right. Like, I was living like a scumbag in sobriety, not doing anything for anybody but myself. And, you know, I was helping a lot of people, and that's all good and fine, but, like, my life wasn't looking great. And, you know, we went back through the steps, and I started to see where, like, I was delusional, you know, and, like, my life wasn't looking that great as so I thought or other people thought. And, you know, when I started to repair the relationships with my family, you know, today I get to – I was just at the Eagles game last night. I understand they lost. It sucked. But I get to have that experience with my father. I've made financial amends for all the, you know, all the financial amends that I had to do. I ended up doing recently, you know, very recently, because again, like, I'm in sobriety and I'm spending money on like diners or buying newcomers like big books and food. But like those collection notes that I had, or like my mom that put me in treatment for a bunch of deductibles, like I didn't pay that back, but I'm making $25 payments to collections and I'm making $25 payments here and there, but like spending a couple hundred dollars to go away for a weekend to like a conference. And he's like, yo, my man, like, what are you doing with your life? Like, you make X amount of dollars and like you can afford this. You're almost 2 years sober. Like, you got to start getting this together. And by the grace of God, like, I ended up getting a new job recently and a big pay bump. And I was able to pay off all my financial amends. I was able to pay my mother back. I was able to pay my father back, collections, debt and credit cards, debt in here, there, and the other. And, you know, thankfully those were all being able to be paid off. And that's amazing, because like, I didn't understand the blockage that I had from God in that period of time. Like, I was just going further and further away from God. Like, it was great. Everything that I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous was awesome, but the spiritual principles, I wasn't practicing all of them. And, you know, it ended up coming to the point where, you know, I started to talk about that 11th step, right? Like, I started to do some things, and I'm now also a leader in church. You know, I'll leave it, you know, real skim surface stuff, but, you know, I was able to have a spiritual experience as a result of this stuff that they talk about, finding out where religious people were right. And every Sunday, me and my family go to church together, and we do the devotionals that they talk about with the family together. And the relationships that we have today are like tremendous. As a result of that, like, my sister comes, my nephew, my parents, their marriage has gotten tremendously better as a result of God's work on them. My life has gotten tremendously better. And same with like all the relationships around, like my family, like extended family has even, you know, been able to show up. And that's where, you know, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous to be able to help other people. And like, I go there to get what I need, to deepen my experience with God. And as a result of that, like, when they talk about the beyond your wildest dreams, like, I hate that stuff. But now today I can truly and honestly say that, like, I'm completely comfortable in my skin, and anything that I can say up here, you can follow me home and spend a night at my house having dinner with my family, and it looks the same exact way that it looks up here. And that's a blessing, because it didn't for a period of time. And like, I'm a great employee. You know, I'm a great brother today, a great son, you know, and I take care of my nephew and I help raise him. My sister's a single mother, and I'm able to be a father figure to my nephew. And that's the beautiful things as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and taking experiences elsewhere and getting and growing and better understanding of God. Like, that stuff's amazing. And I don't know where I would be without that, because I know a lot of people that have come in here and hit spiritual bottoms in Alcoholics Anonymous and go back out. A lot of them are friends of mine. And I'm so thankful that those people that have had that experience came up and said something to me and kept me accountable and was able to talk to me and be able to deepen my experience so I didn't have to make those same mistakes that others have. And it's a blessing, because as a result of other people sitting down with me and talking to me about those things, my life has dramatically been able to change. And I've taken a little different approach in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just, it grows every single time I get to sit down with somebody new, because I'm learning more and I'm going through the steps again. And it's really awesome that I can't stay on the same experience that I had going through the steps in 8 days. Like, I went through the steps very, very quick and short order, because I believe at that time, like, and I still believe in it too. I still go short order with, you know, other people that I work with, because I know for me, like, if I go to the liquor store, I barely make it to my car to be able to drink. So when I come in Alcoholics Anonymous, like, I need something now. I need to get to work and get it, not to get it done, but I need to feel better now. I need to feel that ease and comfort that used to come from a few drinks. Because if I don't get that, why am I here? There's no point. If my life wasn't going to look better and I wasn't going to feel okay in my skin the way I did when I drank, what's the point of coming here? I did a whole lot of the fellowship deal. There's a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous and there's a program. It's a 12-step program. I practice the 12 steps and I practice the program. Do I do fellowship? Yes, I do. And it's an amazing thing, but I stick to the program. And if you're sitting here and you are hitting a spiritual bottom or you haven't had an experience with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you can talk to me. And I have a lot of people that you can talk to that have had this experience. If you're sitting in here and it's not just for the newcomer, it's not just for the dude that's coming out of treatment, it's not the dude that's coming straight off the street, it's for those people that are sitting here with multiple years of sobriety and not feeling okay and not understanding why. And that experience that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous has completely grown my entire life out. And I do also want to say, like, I thank you guys for inviting me out here. And I thank Alcoholics Anonymous and God, because without that stuff, I wouldn't have the life that I have today. I really wouldn't. And it's an amazing experience, and it's an honor and a privilege to stand up here at a podium and have my life changed as a result of these 12 steps and this program. It's amazing. And with that, I'll close.